Hello and welcome back to the cast commentary of The Return of the King.
You made it through part one and you've decided to venture on with us into part two.
I thought we did well in the first disc. I think we can improve on the second one.
I think you're right, Dom.
Alright, let's really try and concentrate.
Okay.
Here you can finally see the scene in which they actually take over the ships.
That was one of the strange moments in the movie, I thought. That when the Corsairs arrived with the army of the dead and Aragorn went around, I thought, how did they get onto...
Oh, man.
Was that Pete?
That was Pete Jackson who just got that then.
Yet another Peter shot. Peter killed by an arrow of Legolas.
That's kind of cool, isn't it, that I get to kill Pete?
I always spot Pete straight away in his cameos. He's just got such a physical presence and physicality about him, you know.
Let's put it this way, it's not often you manage to get to kill your director, is it?
This scene was created entirely in a motion cap studio. Well, obviously not the Elijah part, but certainly my part in this.
Great moment for Gollum as he is sort of using his manipulative tools.
And here, it's like Sméagol's crowning moment of achievement in terms of carrying out the plan.
It's the only way. It's the only way.
There you see a very brief glimpse of Sméagol panicking and Gollum taking over, because Sméagol really begins to wimp out at that point, because it's not going to work.
I always feel sorry for Andy, because anytime he meets anyone new, he has to do the voice.
Yeah.
To show he's Gollum, which is...
I think at some point he's going to say, give a kind of presti and say after, whatever it might be, say March the 12th.
Yeah.
I will never do the voice again.
Right.
Except for perhaps maybe for, you know, charity purposes. Or maybe for the movie Gollum.
Revenge.
Yeah.
There's a sense that you don't know where Sméagol is. Sméagol and Gollum is at this point. We hear him saying this way, and eventually silence. It's really hard trying to create distance as an actor in an ADR stage when you're trying to throw your voice, when you're trying to... You sort of want to project, but it wasn't right to project, but I was trying to do the sound effect rather than be Sméagol shouting. I was trying to create the effect of Sméagol shouting from different... We're just watching these shots in the ADR, on the ADR stage. It took me quite a long time to actually get just those off lines, which is strange when you think about, you know, lip syncing being difficult. It was creating the off lines was actually more difficult.
I've actually been in films where there was a different type of web or a different technology to create the web. It wasn't nearly as rubbery. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
It wasn't as...
Elastic.
Elastic, good. Wet as well, because this was quite moist. You also spray it down, and it would retain moisture.
I'm looking for a word with the letter P, like pungy or something. No.
Pungy?
Not a word.
It is now.
In the Sean dictionary.
I love that stunt, I think, is incredible. The fact that the camera's leaning right out over the shoulder, over the stuntman's shoulder, did Sam's fall there. Steve Rheinfeld.
Wait, what a spill.
Right. Whoa. There,
that's Steve.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh.
That's Steve. Oh. And he really fell long and far. And actually, if you freeze frame it on the wide shot of the falling, you can actually see his face. That moment with the Lembas bread and realizing what Gollum has done was kind of a hard moment for me, because... in my mind, like, I think so quickly about a lot of different things, just Sean does, that Sam, Peter really wanted was this sort of slow burn of realization as he discovers the bread and realizes what... So, but it felt like a throwback to 50s kind of movie acting, you know, the sort of like, oh, I know what's happening. So it was really, we did a lot of takes of it, and I remember just feeling like...
You just have to dumb yourself down.
I feel like such a boob.
Because, you know, Sam's a little dense.
A little slower.
A little slower.
Dense?
Well, maybe not.
You heard it here first, folks.
Sorry. Sam's not dense. I didn't mean that.
He didn't go listen to that dumb creature walk into the cave with a spider.
It's very true. Our most beloved star.
Did you ever visit this set?
No, I didn't.
I didn't either. I'd like to.
Yeah, I think Elijah had a few highly stressful days of just being wrapped up in sticky, horrible stuff.
Yeah.
Terrifying. Absolutely terrifying.
Oh. Yeah, there's a lot of scuttling going on there, Dom.
Yeah.
That spider is the most realistic giant spider I've ever seen on screen, hands down.
Pete's scared of spiders, isn't he?
Obviously, Peter's revenge on the spiders that he hates so much.
The comment that Pete made about spiders that he liked, which I think he does put into Shelob quite a lot, is the thing that scared him the most about spiders is that they move very quick and then they stop. Then they move and then they stop. Then they move and then they stop. They don't do that kind of... It's not the tarantula-type movement that he's scared of, this kind of slow, lackadaisical thing. It's the scuttle and then the immediate freeze that scares him. But he's very squeamish of spiders. So I'm sure this sequence was fun for him.
How'd they stick him up, though?
I don't know. I'll let Elijah answer that question.
Elijah? How'd they stick you up there?
Well, I'm actually, I'm not hanging up by sheer strength of the web. They've got me on a harness, and each of my arms has a band around it that has a wire connected to it to hold me up.
Now this is Smeagol, so thrilled, so delighted, so excited that he can't stop himself singing. We tried it in lots of different ways, ranging from operatic to burlesque, and then it goes horribly wrong for him. He suddenly realizes he's got to get out.
The web, like, you really look like you're stuck at, like...
And it is truly, honestly sticky as well, so it's... That was not something I had to fake. It's very difficult to kind of get all that stuff, to break through it and get it off of you. All of the fighting in this particular scene was shot with me and Andy.
This was shot, again, using motion capture on set. Which is a very difficult thing to do when you're doing a fight, because the suit can get torn to pieces and all the dots can come flying off and then the data gets ruined and then you have to reshoot it. And it was very brutal, this fight, and we really laid into each other, as you can see.
I can't remember if I did a pass without... I did do a pass without him, but we did do each shot, we would do multiple takes with Andy, where we would be fighting each other, and then we would do a couple of passes where I would be fighting thin air. But there's that kind of muscle memory that comes into it.
And we'd motion captured this, we'd shot all this scene, but there was this one beat which Pete and Fran really decided that we needed, which is kind of around now. When I went in to do my ADR in London, Pete said, right, get down on the floor. It was in the carpet at his home where he was staying in London, and I want to shoot this connective scene where Smeagol almost for a moment sees life without the ring and the pressure of that and the burden of it before Gollum takes over. It's this moment now. Just that little shot. It was the last thing I ever filmed on Lord of the Rings, and it was on Peter Jackson's carpet in his house in London. And that day, he cut it immediately into the movie and emailed it over to New Zealand. And that afternoon, I was doing the voice for that shot. And it really represents the kind of high-tech, low-tech marriage for me of what the entire filmmaking experience was about. And the perfection that he was after, that even at that point, weeks before delivery of the film, you're still searching for a moment that is going to make the scene better. And it's such a rare, rare thing to work with someone who's prepared to do that. And also has got the guts to do it and wants to do it at that stage after having worked on these productions for such a long time.
Reconnecting with Galadriel, I think, is nice too.
Yeah.
I sort of see Galadriel as, in some ways, his guardian angel or a bit of a guide, you know. But there is something really ambiguous about Galadriel, that's something slightly frightening about her as well.
This task was appointed to you.
Galadriel's my grandmother, which seems impossible to believe because she's so young and gorgeous.
No one will.
I was so excited when I heard that Kate was going to be a part of this film because she's just... absolutely my favorite actress, and I think she is so talented, and as a matter of fact, when she came to set to film, I would go and just sort of creep up and spy on her and watch her while she was filming, because I was so intrigued by how she worked.
So this bit here was one of the more difficult bits of riding. It looks pretty simple, but the ground is very uneven and the path was very tricky, full of rabbit holes and rocks. For the scene, the pace wanted to be as urgent as possible as Aemir comes to report the state of Gondor to Théoden.
The enemy advance. Time is against us. Make ready!
And they're in a hidden part of the encampment. Otherwise, Théoden would have seen them and sent them home where they should be.
Yeah, she looks pretty conspicuous standing right there in the middle of everyone. she's not supposed to be there.
Don't really know why this wasn't kept in the theatrical release. This would probably be the scene I was the most disappointed about losing.
Said that about the last one?
That's a good point. Great deeds,
but I'm not. Yeah, it was a nice moment for them to kind of build their relationship and... story-wise, what was making them go?
You know, it just adds some nice layering on the relationship of Merry and Eowyn. He's very fond of Eowyn. I think he feels very connected to her in the way that he feels sorry that she's not being really given the opportunity to prove her worth the same way that he isn't.
I wish I could see them again. A lovely scene, that. Mm. I hadn't seen it before. Beautifully played, Dom.
Oh, stunning work.
No, it really was.
Yeah. Make haste!
We ride through the night! That says, we will ride through the night, that trumpet sound. It's kind of code. It's Rohan trumpet code. Can you hear it? We will ride through the night. We will ride through the night.
Oh, but those bloody helmets. Those helmets. I always felt like such a moron by the time I put that helmet on. Like an egghead.
Flaming balls.
You know, ultimately what...
You know what I love about Grond, that battering ram thing?
Yeah.
Is that when they show the cave trolls... I remember in The Fellowship, one cave troll was like the signature thing in the movie. Now you see like a baker's dozen of them and you don't even think twice about it. And just the sheer physics of them pulling on the rope and using the levers of to have that thing pulled back. I mean, it just... It has such weight to it, physical weight. I mean, you just can imagine being a human being standing next to that towering thing battering into the door. It just...
It's one hell of a battering ram.
Well, this is new. Talk us through this, Bill.
Okay. This was, Gandalf has told Pippin to go up, get himself out of danger. But he knows that Denethor's gone slightly mad.
Cuckoo.
He's lost it. This puppy's gone. Denethor, hello. What's going on with you?
He's thinking here. What's he up to? Gondor is lost. Again, filmed in that set, just outside Wellington. Oh, you see?
A flower is blooming.
On the dead tree.
So what does that mean? Does that mean that the tide is changing?
Hope.
Yeah, what are you hoping that it means?
There is hope now.
Oh, there is hope.
Yeah.
That's good. Until someone walks past and picks it off and puts it in their hair.
Better to die sooner than late.
Probably the most challenging thing, and sort of unfair thing in a way, was doing ADR 3 years after I'd done the performance, because normally one would do it within a month or two while it's still fresh, which meant that, you know, I had to revisit those emotions again. And because I was probably in another mode, I actually pushed my voice too hard and lost it. Day. Whereas when you're in the motor playing the character, that wouldn't happen. And there was tremendous pressure around at that stage to get the film finished.
Bring wood and oil.
How do they do that sound, man? Grond. Oh, gosh, that thing is so amazing.
At that time, we didn't know who Grond was or what Grond was. And then I found out later on that it's this huge, really huge battering ram. Huge wolf's head. I think it was out of iron to bring the actual doors down so we can get in and crush them.
Boom.
I love the trolls.
See, even Gandalf's shocked by that.
Well, yeah. Minas Tirith was built in exactly the same place as Helm's Deep was. And both me and Dom never worked in Helm's Deep, but we did visit it just to see, you know, what it was like, because everyone was saying how close it was to hell with all the battles and stuff. So we went up and had a look one night. And it was quite funny to go back up, and this same place was a completely different set.
That is right out of Alan Lee's drawing, that image right there.
Sure is.
Sheila behind you.
I love how Alan Lee's work was oftentimes copied directly onto screen, which is wonderful, because it is such wonderful work that people are so familiar with. There was something of a puzzle in the way that these movies were shot. There were just little pieces of the puzzle that were being, you know, little moments here, little moments there. And I really enjoyed that as an actor, because then you could really commit, as opposed to committing to a whole. Oftentimes you were called on to commit to a moment and make that moment perfect, and I really enjoyed that.
Every time I watched this in the cinema, there was always a gasp.
Great audience moment. I mean, the audience is just terrified now.
I love how the sting is slightly wet.
And when this thing goes into you, I remember watching it for the first time on the looping stage in London and just being, just
that
knowing
stinger
that.
The stinger really hurt, too.
I know, man. Did it hit your spinal cord, or did it stop just short of there?
Just short of the spinal cord.
But
they had to shorten it, though, because they realized that it was too long.
It was too long.
Spent a couple of days in the hospital after that, but it was worth it, and as you can see.
I know, we told everybody that it was appendicitis, but
that was the excuse.
Maybe that's what caused your appendicitis.
One of my favorite key sequences in the book, Sam fighting Shelob. Very graphic. I think something that Pete really enjoyed getting his teeth into. This, once again, would be horrible for Sean Astin to film, because obviously, you know, she's not there.
I'm sure Sean will take you through that.
On you go, Sean.
Well, it was just my imagination, really. I mean, there was no show. They had a big plastic spider that they tried to do for one shot, and it was just terrible. It didn't work. So we just went to total CG.
I got a plastic leg at one point.
Yeah.
But, which I don't even know if it's in the film.
And when we were doing one of the reshoots, I was always really proud of the fact that I could see the spider in my imagination, just based on, I finally was getting to do a really heroic fight scene. You know, it wasn't Aragorn, it wasn't Legolas, it was like little Sam gets to fight the big spider, and I've been waiting for that moment for so long to be able to shoot that fight sequence and with the spider. And all I had to do, you know, they'd say where my eye line was supposed to be for it, and when we would click into the drama, I could just do it. I could turn and, there she was, and I could muster all the requisite fear and anger and hatred and violence and everything else. And then we went back, I remember, in August or July or August of 2003, months before the film's going to hit the theaters, and we were doing a scene where a couple of reaction shots to Shelob, and I couldn't see the spider anymore. I was like, I would turn and I would look, and I just sort of, I wasn't in it. And I thought, I'm a bad actor. I can't do it anymore. I can't see the spider. Because I had already seen a version of the sequence cut together, and it was so good that I just...
That's so, probably it. You'd seen a bit of it.
I had seen it. I was just too exhausted. I just couldn't do it anymore. And I did it. I mean, I remember punching myself in the stomach and slapping myself in the face and doing that barking thing that I used to do. Yeah, kind of like that.
Just you knew Sean was on set when
in the bark. Yeah. So I did that to try and wake myself up and do it. And finally did it. But it was a moment of crisis and self-doubt, because I couldn't see the spider anymore.
Oh, man. There's a metaphor.
Very difficult for an actor to sit and not blink for a long, long time.
He's very good at it, Elijah.
I guess I have a bit of a reputation for my ability to stare.
One of the theories that Billy and I came upon was that because Elijah wears contact lenses, we thought that maybe in the early part of his life, he kept his eyes wide open, straining to see what was going on, that they just stayed like that.
Don't go where I can't follow.
This was my audition scene.
Really?
Don't go, Mr. Frodo, don't go where I can't follow. I remember feeling like, oh, geez, it was too melodramatic, or it was too when we were shooting it, I remember thinking...
No, not at all.
No, I know. Not in the context of the movie, but I remember feeling a little bit like the weight of the movie sort of transferred to me for a moment.
Well, I think that there were times in which all of us felt that way because of the nature of how the movies were shot. So suddenly we'd come to a moment that was so intense and so dramatic, and you weren't always able to lock into the context of where it would fit. And suddenly you'd find yourself, you know, feeling slightly over-dramatic and too much. And I know what you're saying, totally.
It's an interesting plot moment, like, Shelob's killed you, I think you're dead. There were a lot of different ways that it was handled in the adaptation, in the screenplay adaptation, and then I think they were still finding their way of mechanically, just structurally, how does Sam know when Frodo's gone? You know, and those little reaction shots I sort of felt were kind of after the fact or something. Maybe they weren't. Maybe they were always in there. And I do that a lot sometimes. I'll forget what's in the screenplay, and then when we're shooting it, it feels like a totally new thought to me or something. But those moments felt a little bit awkward for me because I just sort of thought, boy, I'm just giving important expository information to the audience about how Sam does stuff. It felt like I was needing to vocalize things. If it were real, if it weren't drama, you'd see it and you'd have that realization. But to actually say it out loud feels like you're doing it for the audience's benefit, to get them to understand both for themselves and for you what your thought process is. It's just a little clunky there.
Peter's very respectful to actors. He would assume that we would do what we were paid to do and bring something to it. He would, at the beginning, on the block through, talk about the scene, but we didn't have the liberty of having rehearsals anywhere else beforehand. We just jumped in, and it was always fine. And we saw eye to eye. With so much on his mind, he had to trust the actors to bring their material to the set, which they always did.
That was Topo pulling me out there.
Right.
And in this shot here, that's Fawn who gets thrown out, and I was just lying underneath the camera. So when she rolled, she kind of hit my back, and then I would sit up. It's a very kind of low-tech way of doing it, but actually quite hard, because if she rolled and the wrong part of her was kind of hitting my back, like her back hit my back when I popped up, it just looked really comic.
Yeah.
And it just happened this one take that it just worked kind of perfectly. Because we didn't think, well, we thought we'd try it a couple of times, and if it doesn't work, we'll try something else. It just seemed to work.
Well, congratulations to you and Fawn.
And also Pete.
Because we had been on it for so long, you could just tell these certain characteristics of a lot of the people under the prosthetics. That's Joel all over. I can tell which one's Pete, which one's Robert Pollock. You just say it by name, but all the other cast and crew couldn't. Now, who's under there? Now, who's that? Now, who's this? Every time you'd eat, your makeup artist will be watching you like a hawk. Because when you eat, all the prosthetics that's around your mouth would start really giving way because of the moisture. And mixing them with the glue, it really just loosens up the prosthetics and then starts to peel away. Because I'll be eating, enjoying like a chicken leg or something like that, or spare ribs or something like that. And you know how you eat spare ribs. Well, I couldn't eat. I had to eat my spare ribs with a knife and a fork and cut it up nice and finely and just the shit into my mouth, because my makeup artist would have one eye on me and one eye on his own food.
And in this shot here, I stood on a sort of catapult thing, and then when Gandalf grabbed my hand, they fired this catapult so that I shot up in the air.
Nah.
Yeah, it was kind of scary because you thought if I miss it, you know, it just might fire me anywhere. And when I did this scene, I was actually on the horse with Ian. We just made it work. You know, just hunkered way down.
Do you not know death?
No, not a lot of people know this. What? But the voice of the Witch King was done by Andy Serkis. Was it really? I didn't even know that. No, he kept it very quiet.
I did, actually. Yes, I did. Smeagol, gone, thank you. What we tried to do with the Witch King was, in fact, to have this sense of this being a void in his face, that there was an in and out breath that was reverberating around this hollow skull, this hollow shell inside this helmet. So we worked very hard, and I think when I was trying to create the voice, which was in the ADR sessions, we recorded level. Fran had this idea of recording levels, layers and layers and layers of me doing that. So I'd be doing breathing in and out at the same time as speaking, which was then layered on top of each other.
But this idea, I suppose, of taking head-on improbable odds is probably something that we still do today, but it's something that probably comes from chivalrous times past, and probably Tolkien's experience in the First World War coloured his decision to write this the way he wrote it.
See, the helmet doesn't suit Bernard either. Actually, the only really good helmet wearer in this movie is Carl. He wears the helmet really well.
Really? I thought I looked circumcised in my helmet. I loved my helmet, though. Wouldn't trade it for the world. In fact, they gave it to me at the end.
Most people's helmets look quite cool.
Yeah.
Maybe not Miranda's.
No.
Helmets are just really hard, I think, for girls to wear well. And we actually went back and redesigned the helmet a little bit when we went back for the reshoots, because mine was just so big, it made my head look about 5 inches taller than what it already was, so I had this big egg head. And then putting them on, the eyes always go off center and drags your wig off, and oh, the helmets are a drag.
The scene, the Ride of the Rohirrim, it was a very special scene for me, because all this thing with the clapping of the spears was all my idea right from the very beginning. And then I realised I couldn't do it if they'd asked me to do it the next day, so I upgraded myself as a rider.
Bernard was telling me that he trained a lot for this horse stuff.
And the way Pete set it up, the idea of the spears and the sword down the spears, and I'm left-handed. And I'd always had it in my head that I would ride up and down left-handed. My scabbard was on my right hip. So I had to ride down to the end of the line and pull the horse, who was all pumped up, rein him in, try and calm him down enough for me to get my sword out with my left hand, change the sword from my left hand to my right hand, and the reins from my right hand to my left hand. And anyone who's been anywhere near a horse or knows anything about leather realises that with thick gloves on, that is not an easy thing to do. This is all me. This is no stuntman in here at all. I did the whole lot. A combination of my idea and my determination to be the rider that could do it.
Bernard's sword was pretty bent at the end of it. It was only an aluminium sword. You could get to the end of it and have to spend a couple of minutes straightening the sword for each take.
Because we'd use kind of lightweight aluminium swords for some of this stuff, there was no way that I could clatter my sword down a whole load of real wooden spears and it not end up being bent like some kind of improbable piece of armoury. So we had to use the hero sword in my weaker hand, and that was really quite hard. Just added one more added difficulty for the whole day. But we did it. Paid off.
So it was a pretty amazing experience to be on set, just be part of this massive charge, and the ground was shaking and just the most thunderous charge. I remember at one point I was at the end of the field watching one of the takes, and the ground was literally shaking at this 500 odd horses galloping down the field.
How many horses do you think were there, Don?
There was
actual real ones.
Well, I remember speaking to Pete, and he said he gave me a ballpark figure, he didn't know exactly, but he said it was at least 11.
Yeah. Well, that's 7 now.
On any
4 of them just went.
Oh, 3 left. All the rest are computer generated. On any given day, he said there was at least 11. To have 11 horses live and all running in the same direction on the set is an incredible achievement.
Yeah. Thankfully, the cameraman caught it. I'd been rehearsing it, trying to look for some piece of action that I could do for AMO when he was riding, charging into battle, so I would rehearse getting my spear and flicking it up without looking at it. It would spin in the air and then I could catch it, and then it would shift it from riding position to throwing position. It took months and months of practice time. I guess that's, you know, one of the great things about this film is they actually allowed us to do as much as we felt comfortable doing. So if you invested time and energy into perfecting your skills, your sword fighting, your horse riding, you know, consequently you got to do a lot.
This is interesting. People often ask me, what was that? I know that our department had found a combination of glycerin and some other things that was looked effective but wasn't toxic. So that's what I poured on myself. Interesting thing about this scene, we had to get it in one because I'd basically covered me and my wig and my costume in oil. If we'd had to do it again, I would have had to go home and I'd have to go out and wash the wig and put it in. But we didn't have to. There's a huge feeling of excitement on the set that day because that's a really dangerous stunt. And, you know, So there was a tension and excitement. And when he pulled it off and got it right, there was such elation. High fives everywhere. And the team that had been assembled, they were all there to support him on that day, all of his stunt buddies. It was very exciting.
And this is probably my favourite moment of yours in the film, that bit right there.
Right.
I remember thinking, it's my mate, huh?
Kind of really grows up there, I think, eh?
Yeah. Were you pushing tall Paul there?
Yes, and then there was actually some shots which get cut out where I'm actually really going at Dennis or punching him, and when he grabs hold of me there, and that was a stuntman who was set on fire, and then I had to grab him and I was punching him and stuff, and I think Philippa said they cut that out because they didn't want to see a hobbit doing that sort of violence, you know?
Right.
Especially to not an orc.
Yeah.
But that was so much fun to film because there was people around with the fire extinguishers, and I had to put stuff on my eyebrows to make sure they didn't go on fire because there was just fire everywhere.
Now here's Denethor, watch this now. He goes out the door now, he's got about 300 yards to run, and there he is. And this is another thing I said with Peter. I said, he must be a hell of a fast runner. I said, well, I suppose you would do if you're on fire. He said, well, I got this image of him, and he gets halfway down, he thinks, my parachute, and he pulls the cord to the parachute, and the parachute lights, and of course the flames then burn the parachute. Denethor's doomed. Wonderful idea of this flaming person with a flaming parachute behind him.
I think the fight sequences were definitely the most physically challenging and exhausting aspect of the whole production, for me anyway. Because, you know, you're fighting under a ton of armour and you're doing multiple takes.
Oh, now what's this? What the F are these?
Come on, Michael. I think these guys are probably the coolest bad guys in the entire trilogy. The tattoos and the face painting and all that kind of stuff.
Now, what would you do, really? You'd say, okay, fine, game's up, okay, it's 1-0. But what does Théoden do? He says, come on, chaps, let's take them on. That's it, great, let's just tackle these elephants head on. It's a brilliant piece of theatre, that, isn't it, really? You've got this improbable situation, a load of horses, and these giant mummikill with barbed wire between their tusks, and they just says, come on, guys, just let's go get them. Brilliant. Just a wonderful bit of theatrical filming.
I got off to a bad start, actually, with this lead mummikill here, because first day I met him, I showed him a mouse, and he's terrified.
Mummikills don't like mice.
Oh, they don't. I realised that was his Achilles heel.
We did an awful lot of this, riding around, swerving away from nothing, on the lawn in the ex-paint factory in Wellington. Swerving around, dodging God knows what, with Pete trying to describe what the mummikill looked like.
They get you to stand in front of a green screen and they put a bow in your hand and they say, okay, fire erratically, and then they put a spear in your hand, okay, throw a few spears, and some of it's like that, and then some of it's more specific. I mean, at the end we're really just trying to grab what we could, and you know, you only need a couple of seconds of great footage, that's all it takes. You'd get home at the end of the day and literally there wouldn't be a part of your body that didn't ache. You wouldn't even have energy to go out to dinner or make dinner. You would just collapse at the end of the day.
Great thing about battle sequences now is that because there's so many battle sequences in films, you have to keep setting a new level of quality, you know. And that's what Pete's done again, is said to people, if you're going to do battle sequences, this is the standard that people now expect, which is great.
Now this is some spear throwing. This is Olympic standard javelin chucking, really, this is.
So what happens there? He kind of gives the mummikill a piercing.
No, he's dearing the mummikill.
Ah.
And he does it by pulling its ears, which are attached to sort of ropes and then to earrings. So when he falls, he pulls it completely on the left, which, you know, if somebody pulls your ear really hard on the left,
you go left. This would all be green screen work right here. All the stuff of us stabbing left and right.
Yeah, that stuff. Oh, gosh, we were in the studio all day doing that. Trying to pretending to slash at elephants' legs that weren't there and throw spears and sit on this horse. By the time we went back for the reshoots, I had to shoot a lot of my stuff on the phony pony. They made a whole horse, like mechanical horse, for us to work on.
Just 2 or 3 hours of me and Miranda sat on the horse, and they just say, action, and you'd go for as long as you can, just stabbing in lots of different directions, and then they'd add all the stuff later.
Whoa.
I actually did do some stuff with Miranda, me and Miranda on the same horse, because Pete said when you got close up, you really couldn't tell the difference. It was difficult kind of taxing stuff, because you don't really know what you're doing. Pete filled us in, but I think this Mama Kill was supposedly at the time, and I think it might still be the biggest prop ever built.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, is that a recognition shot of Bernard C. Miranda, yeah?
I would think so, yeah.
Oh, this is... Nice, Merry in Battle, check it out. This was all shot in the reshoots. I'd said for a long time to Pete that I would have really liked to have done some battle sequences as Merry, just to show how horrifying it's going to be for a hobbit to be at the very centre of battle.
I watched Miranda do this, some of this stuff. She just wore herself out doing that. And you can see at the end of every take, she'd get more and more tired and fall over more and more quickly at the end of every take.
And then afterward, I was absolutely bruised all over my body, and my neck was out in 3 places, and my back was out. And the next day, luckily, I didn't have to shoot because it rained, but I don't think I would have been able to shoot again the next day. I was in such a mess.
I didn't think it would end this way.
This is a lovely scene between Ian and Billy.
Now the journey doesn't end here. Splendid words to say, and I suppose touching that Gandalf should choose to say them as words of comfort to a young man. I suppose in different circumstances I might have wanted to put a rather cynical edge on the scene, because what right has a commander who's got his troops into this particular problem to be telling them how wonderful it's going to be when we're dead?
What?
You know? That's what commanders have been saying to the troops through the generations.
Working with Ian was pretty special. He's a bit of a legend in British theatre, and I've worked quite a bit in British theatre as well, and we kind of approach the scenes the same way you would in the theatre, where, you know, we'd talk through it, and Pete was very up for that. He's a very giving actor. You know, when you look in his eyes, you get a lot back. You know, you can ask for nothing more. So I had a fantastic time working with Ian. Learned a lot.
And this is another place at Queen Elizabeth Park. And I don't know what this thing looks like. It was never adequately described to us what it looked like.
Uh-oh.
Nazgul didn't want to do it that day. Just threw us along the ground, you know. You can't get good Nazgul at all these days. They don't do what you tell them.
The Nazgul's one of those creatures, actually, that turned out exactly how I thought it would. That's exactly the picture I had of it in my mind from reading the book.
I had no idea what we were looking at here. Not a clue. And there's a terrible scene, terrible moment, when she kind of runs towards the Nazgul to defend her uncle and stands on the horse. If things weren't bad enough, she stands on the horse and adds her weight to the pressure on my broken body. I think they cut that out, but we did it.
When we were rehearsing, we would rehearse in like gym gears, but there she's got all this chainmail on that she didn't really cater for. And with all these chopping and stuff, it really takes a lot out of you. I was fine with my costume, but with all that chainmail, there's a scene further on where I have to just keep using the Morning Star and just keep on whacking it at her to get that reaction from her as this mace is coming down and about to smash her, because that's what Peter wanted, get that close-up reaction of her reacting to it, then moving, not wait for a beat, then move, get the reaction, then move. And I had to just keep on doing it, just keep on doing it, and I went for about like 5 minutes straight, and she had just had to move. I come in again, she had to move from that spot, to come in again, move from that spot. And I was going, oh mate, and I could see it in her face, that it was really frustrating for her. And I was going, Pete, cut, 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 say cut, because this is really wearing her out. And she had to move off the ground. It's not an easy thing to do, especially when you're all got chainmail.
I don't think I was there when they shot the Corsair sequence, because they did some in pickups. And what I noticed, where we hop off the boats, it was a digital double for my jump off the boat, because I didn't do that. I would remember that. That's kind of weird when you see that, you know, because you always know, if I'd been there, there would have been a great moment to play. But can't always get everywhere, so.
Nah, you're all full of confidence, aren't you, Aragorn, just because you've got 50 million dead people behind you.
Yes. I love the Army of the Dead. It's such a great idea.
Yeah, this scene, I had to slowly pick her up. And it was really hard with that glove to try and get a bit on her neck, because her buckle underneath her chin kept on getting in my way. And I'm just trying to grab her skin. Yeah, that was that helmet and everything that was around her. I couldn't get a good grip.
Now, she had to wear that helmet for all that time just so she could whip it off and make that moment dramatic.
I am no man.
In this scene, Peter, you know, as soon as you get stabbed, there's this initial shock to the actual stabbing. So I just want you to be shocked at first. We'll play it again, and she'll stab you again, and then there's the shock. Then there's the shake, there's the shiver, there's the shimmy, and then you're all starting to crumple and just slowly dissipate in the end. And then another loud roar from the crowd. When the bad guy dies, there's always that big cheer. I don't know. You gotta love the bad guys. Yeah.
Now that's a bad hair day. I just keep mucking up the hair more and more. And it's not gonna match with the hair later on. Oh, that's right. We just dragged myself along the ground all day on that one. I think I'm trying to make my hair really messy so Aragorn wouldn't see my face and he wouldn't know that it was me. Vigo's the best fighter of all, though, of course. He just has such a great style. So fluid.
Get it, Miranda, get it.
Get it? Oh, God. You'll never make it? Oh.
I never got to see that before. So that's where Aragorn killed him.
Orlando practiced for this sequence by climbing animals in his downtime. We'd be off surfing, Orlando would climb ponies, horses, cows,
yeah,
mules, donkeys.
But before he got to animals like that, he was on gerbils, hamsters, and...
Remember the time when the rat bit him?
Bet I'm right in these.
He couldn't go out for days.
They had built in one of the studios a huge pile of sandbags, which were kind of basically the back end of the mummicule. And they got arrows in it that I had to climb up, and there was a piece up on top where the stunt guys were all gathered ready to fight me. And there were wires running around it, and I was swinging, you know, so that it was like when I was swinging down the side of the leg, they had the option to use parts of my shot there. I know they basically used a lot of my digital double, so I had to have a very serious conversation with my digital double and make sure I knew exactly what his motivation was. It was great to have that moment, you know.
That face that he pulls there, he actually pulls when he sees a girl that he fancies. It's kind of his sexy face. Look, yeah, this hair. Yeah, that kind of...
That still only counts as one!
Very popular, that line. I get asked to write that on people's autographs all the time. I think it's probably something that I'd improvise and Peter liked, and you know, I'd probably improvise a dozen different variants of it. Then he turned around and said, no, you got to do that one, that's the one we really like.
And there they go. It reminds me of, you know, when you put that stuff down the toilet and it cleans off all the lime scale. It's kind of like that, isn't it, really? Everything comes out shiny and clean. Now, this is the scene we did at Queen Elizabeth Park, and then when we did the reshoot, I'd done my bit, and I got my farewell party and all that kind of stuff. And then Miranda said, I don't think you're finished. I think we're going to do your death scene again. And I said, no, get out of here. I'm going on holiday. I'm going down the South Island. And she said, well, you better check out before you go.
I actually got wrapped and was told I was going home, and then I said to Bernard, were we going to shoot that scene again or not? You know, should we go back and ask them? So I went to ask, and then they actually pulled us back and we ended up doing it. But there was a lot of indecision about whether we should do it or not, because Pete, I think, was pretty happy with it, the original one, but Philippa and Fran felt like it could be better.
And Philippa Boyne said, because you two have developed so much as actors and as a partnership, and because you're good friends and so on, and we think we can write it better, and we think you can act it better, we think we can shoot it better, so we're going to do it again.
And the whole idea, I think, that they wanted to get in the scene was that he was the one telling her that she had to accept it, that she couldn't fight it. They wanted to get that across, that the person who was dying was actually saying that you have to let me go, and that is something that quite often happens in life, that it's the people who are living who can't accept that someone will die, and the person who's dying who is more ready and able to accept it.
The death scene was very appropriately the last scene that I shot on Lord of the Rings, and very appropriately it was with Miranda, because I'd done, I think, some very significant work with her, and she with me. I hope she feels that way. So to have that as my very last piece of work on it, apart from the occasional voice work and commentary like this, it was essentially my last piece of acting, live acting, on the whole experience.
I love Minas Tirith, I just love looking at it.
Yeah, you've said that.
Well, I still like it. And I remember Pete was saying, you know, there's all these ghosts, you haven't seen them before, you're amazed. And he talked me through it. Am I right? I'm amazed, but you're also a little bit scared.
Scared amazement?
Yeah.
It's one of your easiest faces to pull, isn't it?
Yeah, I got that in one take.
Yeah.
Bad idea. Very handy in a tight spot, these lads, despite the fact they're dead.
Peter always had a core of stuff that he wanted me to do as written, as agreed, and all that. And then he was always very keen for me to improvise a little bit, because sometimes I would improvise something and it coincided with what he was trying to do, and he would utilize it.
What I found confusing is, why did they let them go, all the dead people? Why did they wait till the job was over?
And where do they go now? Do they just...
Well, they can go now and relax. They don't have to go back to that bad place.
Go and watch ESPN Sports Centre.
I'm looking for you, Dom.
What have you found? You found...
Look at all the death and...
Is that my cloak?
Yeah. Do you know, I actually asked for that, because originally I was supposed to find your sword. And I said, how would I know it was his sword? And they said, well, it's smaller. I thought, well... I just think it was a dagger. So we worked out that, yeah, the cloak would be a better thing.
Oh, this is back in. Oh, yeah, I was disappointed for Carla that wasn't in the movie. I thought he did that really well.
You can't prepare for something like that. You go in there and put yourself in that situation. And how I would feel if the last surviving member of my family was lying dead, well, at least if I thought they were dead, lying before me. I mean, just a raw outpouring of grief. It's just raw. I only did about 3 or 4 takes, I think, and that was it.
Uh-huh. I'm actually meant to have the black breath here as well, but that's a hard concept to kind of get across, so... It's not really about the arm, it's more about, I suppose, an internal ailment.
I was doing ADR, and they were about to shoot the Houses of the Healing, and my character wasn't actually in the scene, and I said to Philippa, I said, look, after that sort of massive display of grief and anguish, and don't you find it odd that he's not by her side? And she said, well, yeah, it is a bit. Let me talk to Pete. And so she went away and talked to Peter, and then I got a call from them that night saying, yeah, we're shooting the House of the Healing tomorrow. We think you should be there. That's how come I'm in this scene.
I'd done a radio play with Miranda about 10 years before. This was in the days when they actually did radio plays in Australia. But there was one particular sequence where we had to have sex in a bath. And they actually had a bath in the studio with the microphones in the bath and the two of us standing in the bath pretending to have sex. But Miranda and I just couldn't contain ourselves. So laughed for a little bit too long for the director, who got rather annoyed with us both. But after that, this was the next time I saw Miranda in the Houses of Healing on... my very first day on Lord of the Rings.
Mary!
Oh, right. So showing the passage of time. You've been looking for me all day.
Yeah, not so much like you. In real life, I'd have looked for about an hour and a half.
Yeah. Just call me on my cell phone.
Yeah.
In principal photography, we actually shot this in a different way. We shot a sequence of Mary kind of stumbling around, still semi-conscious, and Pippin coming over, and he kind of puts his arm around him and takes him off camera. But Pete, I think, wanted Mary to be still in a bad state and for it to be very clear to the audience that Pippin is taking care of him, so that's why we refilmed it.
And it's pretty clear as well, I think, that you would have died if Pippin hadn't have came.
Yeah.
You know, no one would have looked underneath that.
Yeah.
It's a great scene. It's truncated in the theatrical.
Is that an elephant joke?
Truncated. Yeah.
It's nice to see Dom have so much put back in.
Oh, it is. It's part of being an actor that you pour your heart and soul into a role and into a project. And when it finally sees its release, there's always a sense of disappointment because not everything that you did, not every moment that you played, every single outpouring of your heart is not going to necessarily be present. And
it's a pretty rare thing when the emotional return on your creative investment, you know, seems worth it. I've certainly felt above and beyond the returns of my investment in terms of my time and energy and emotional commitment and everything else.
But I mean, there were certainly scenes in all three of the movies that I had fallen in love with and moments that I really enjoyed filming and in terms of the context of the story that I really appreciated. But
I got attached to different versions of things that I would see edited.
Yes.
That then would change as a function of
yes.
special effects or Howard's music or whatever. And it may actually objectively be better later, but I got so used to it or liked it so much that in a certain incarnation.
Yeah,
know.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's something about this. Were you finished making your point? I interrupted you.
No, I was done. Thank you, Sean.
There's a. I always do that.
You do.
I know, I'm an idiot.
You're not an idiot. You're
kind
of like. You and I are kind of similar in the sense that. I think I'm right in saying this, that both of us, our minds are constantly working, right? And they're moving at a clip, and there's so many thoughts going through our minds at any given time. And that makes us want to speak as soon as we have that thought, because for fear of losing that. So, yeah, you know, I've been known to interrupt as well, Mr. Aston.
I sort of figure if I'm having the thought, wouldn't everybody else want to know what it is?
Right?
If my brain is going through
well,
the trouble of cogitating on it,
to,
yeah.
You
know, just by virtue of the fact that it's me. I think that's a definition of the nature of
hear this
ego.
As well. Yeah, but there you go.
Sean Astin, or Sean Patrick Astin, as he had to be referred to on set, really comes into his own at this point. I love the passage in the book about, you know, the choices of Samwise and all this kind of stuff. I mean, I think Tolkien was a big fan of the everyman hero, and that's what Sam is. I think when you're reading the book, you assume that Frodo is going to, you know, be the hero and come through. But, you know, by the time it gets to this in the film, Frodo's kind of so taken over by the ring that he's a bit helpless, and it's up to Sam to step up to the plate, which he really does.
I love this running up the stairs thing, not because of the little shadow gag where they see a big shadow and then it happens to be just a little hobbit, but I actually felt like I was taking my place in cinematic history, in a tradition of Errol Flynn going up the steps of the Citadel, kind of something about the production design, running up the stairs and having this fight just felt like it was...
It is kind of
right
classic sort of swashbuckler, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially on the staircase.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And getting to push those stunt guys off and not wanting to push them so hard that they missed it.
It's cool for me to see your character like this as well. Because it's not a part of your character that I knew or I was as familiar with making it because most of these moments happen without me.
Yeah.
So it's great for me to see it as well.
Well, you know, we did those 6 weeks of sword training with Bob Anderson, the world-class swordmaster who taught Errol Flynn how to swashbuckle, and he did the
awesome
Darth Vader Obi-Wan fight. So to actually get to do a couple of thrusts and parries and, you know. Now, here's an amazing thing. You see the lighting that's on your body?
Mm-hmm.
I was up in the tower.
The super sexy lighting?
Yeah, the super sexy lighting for Naked Frodo. There's just one other thing that I asked Andrew Lesney. I sort of zinged him with a question that was really kind of an inappropriate thing for an actor to ask a cinematographer.
Exactly. This is a great story.
But I just
listening.
Said to him, to Andrew Lesney, the cinematographer who won an Oscar, I said, "Where is the light coming from? Because we're in this tiny little space, and you know, a lot of times cinematographers, great cinematography is not having, you know, is having the source of the light kind of in evidence or having it be, you know, lighting is just, at this moment, there was light where there would have been no source for it. And he looked at me and he just said, same place as the music. I just thought that
wonderful.
Was so awesome.
It's my hands down favorite quote of Andrew Lesney.
But they
you
actually
look like you're like 12 years old. Sorry.
No, that's right. They kept jiggering with this scene because it was too... They wanted to really imply that maybe Frodo, maybe Sam did. I never wanted to play it like I ever really wanted the ring. I just didn't want to do that. And they kept pushing it. They wanted me to have a moment of like, oh no, maybe I want it because I'm succumbing to it before giving it up.
Right.
So they really are doing a lot of things cinematically. If you toggle between our commentary and what it actually does, you can see.
I mean, the scene drastically changed because the way that I was initially playing it, especially here towards the end, was, you know, in my asking you for the ring, it's my lust for the ring that was asking you for the ring.
But here there's almost a benevolence to it.
But they've changed it.
Yeah.
To be that I sense in Sam a desire for this, and I'm actually taking the ring back or pleading for the ring back to protect you, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, yeah, and it just adds a layer. It adds a layer to Sam too that is not so just pure all the time. It's like, well, the ring, you know, if Sam were,
it is better this way. Absolutely.
What's amazing to me is that close up of me looking at you, kind of awkwardly, was used in a number of different ways as they were evolving the scene, and it's just amazing that one look can take on 15 different meanings depending on what's said right before it or right after it.
Or simply, you know, how the reading of a line in ADR can change the complete
whole
direction of my scene. Of my character.
Yeah.
Because we didn't reshoot any of those moments for me, but it was simply a little bit of added dialogue for off-camera lines and
with
a total change
of
tone.
Yeah.
And then it does it.
Yeah.
It's really amazing.
Yeah. Here we are in our orc armor.
And how screwed was I with that beak?
Now, talking about comedy helmets. We thought we were in a bad place.
And then here come the bird people.
They gave you a choice of helmets, and you grabbed that one, and I just remember thinking, are you insane? Like, what yeah. are you doing?
For a good 20 minutes to a half an hour, you're going to be beat guy.
That's a good look for Elijah, because his best features are his eyes.
Yeah.
Covering up everything else actually makes him look sexier.
And so the nature of Frodo and Sam's heroism is close to what nations have no right to expect, but often get from the young men who they order into battle. To defend what is difficult, I suppose, for the soldier to know. But Frodo is doing it for the Shire. And the idea of the Shire, you know, of all the places that you meet, and all the communities that you meet in Middle-earth, I think it's Hobbiton that most of us would feel, well, that's where I'd like to retire to.
I've sent him to his death.
No. There's still...
My main concern with the theatrical release of this film is that I just don't know if there's enough of Aragorn.
Of our king.
Of our king and the process that he goes through to become king and ultimately the decisions he has to make and his journey at that final hour to accept his destiny, and I just don't know that that's strong enough.
He was so committed to finding layers of poetry and layers of nuance in terms of his sensitivity to be juxtaposed against his incredible prowess as a swordsman or his ruggedness as Strider. And I know that Peter and Fran really honored his passion and his level of commitment to that. But somehow, just as a function of time, when things get cut out of
the theatrical version,
those are the things that go, and then what's left is harmed in some way because he, as an actor, he's creating the overall performance with those things in his mind and heart, and he's making choices based on his knowledge of the total thing that's in there.
I love all the stuff with the Palantir.
And I love the idea of the Palantir, this sort of closed-circuit video communication that Sauron has.
The direct link to evil.
But it's his way to sort of peek in on everybody. He's got one, right?
Palantir is a sort of Middle-earth television set, isn't it, really? The problem of all ancient warfare is communication. Where is the enemy? How can I see him? What is he doing? The writer of imaginative fiction can use a device like a Palantir that enables the eye to see. The force that has the best information generally has the best chances of victory. And that's one of the great unfair things that the eye has.
See, the eye of Sauron sees everything. He knows that Aragorn and Arwen have been kissing.
Oh!
Oh, that's how it breaks.
Amazing how many people wear that necklace now. I see it everywhere.
I see it everywhere. It's a beautiful necklace, and also lots of people wear the one ring round the neck.
Yeah.
May I say at this point, Billy, what a beautiful helmet. If you lost your sword, you could just run at people like a battering ram.
I would do that as well.
Skewer a couple.
The city has fallen silent.
It's such a hard thing to get across that she just suddenly meets someone else and then it's all okay. But I like the hand holding. That's from the book. That always struck me as really simple.
That's the other strange thing about that is the fact that if Faramir is such a noble man, surely he'd just be going back out there again, as opposed to trying to crack on to the pretty girl who's, you know, in the ward next to him. And my enduring memory of that day was the fact that being on a film whereby the director could call for as many takes as he did, and Peter, we went for a heap of takes.
I didn't see an orc wearing a helmet like that.
No.
It's just an out-and-out outrageous helmet that's probably been made by the orc helmet maker, and all the orcs said, I'm not wearing that, it looks silly. Let somebody else wear it.
Let's give it the main character in the trilogy.
Yeah.
It'll look good on him.
We shot this thing so many times. We shot this on the actual volcano. Well, that first shot of us sliding down and into that two shot was a pickup. We did that in July on a stage.
2003.
Whereas this shot right here is on the volcano.
Yeah, this is at Rupehu, right?
Yeah.
You know, John Howe does some really evocative pictures. One of them being Samwise stabbing Shelob, which is kind of a famous one. But the one that I like the most is a shot of an orc whipping another orc in this sequence here, and Frodo and Sam being in the middle of these guys and just trying to keep their head down and not be recognised.
By the way, that whipping really hurt. I don't know if you can tell that I'm being whipped there, but it...
Did that hurt?
Well, yeah, because there was... The leather only covered a certain portion of it, so every time he'd hit me, it would put welts. I mean, big, you know, not that you could tell, and then have it cut out.
This is, what a shot.
This was my favorite shot, and I think the end of the shot is actually in the movie.
The end of it is, yeah.
Yeah.
But you don't get the sense that Frodo and Sam are in the
movie. But we sat there on that.
Because what they did is they made it seem like the armies were moving away.
Moving away,
and
yeah.
That they had moved past us. And
oh, here we are back in there.
Not that we were in the mix. But I love that. That sense that Frodo and Sam are, you know, the only way that they can go is in disguise in the mix of exactly where they don't want to be.
I was also, you know, with all the toys and ancillary things, I really couldn't wait to see the action figures of us in orc armor. And I actually think they're my favorite action figure of the five different...
probably my favorite as well. Beak helmet included.
Well, in fact, the beak helmet, you know, we made so many jokes about it, but it really does... It really is a good character. I mean...
I actually like the beak helmet, to be honest with you, Sean.
It's got a sort of Flash Gordon thing with the way the ears are.
It was really easy to take off. All I had to do was grab the beak, you know.
Orc Overseer.
I love the Orc Overseer with his nose completely ripped off. Unbelievable.
Those eyes, those poor guys had to wear those contacts. I mean, they suffered horribly. And a lot of those people are actually New Zealand Army. Who were hired as extras few days.
Hit me, Sam. Stop fighting. Get off of me.
What I find amazing about not only Pete's film, but Tolkien's work, is that you kind of know what's going to happen. You know that Frodo has to destroy the ring, that he has to go to Mount Doom, and it's a very simple story. But never at any point do you get bored and think, come on, just get there, we know it's going to happen. There's always... It holds your attention. And, you know, from the first... 150 pages of the book, you know what the mission is. And to invest all that time, you know, 1,000 pages later in the book shows how incredibly well written it is, and also the way that it's filmed by Pete just keeps your attention as well.
I love that each of these characters that Tolkien has written has a certain amount of ambiguity. They're fully good or fully bad, you know, they're humans, you know. Generally, in these kind of stories, in these sort of fantasy stories, you have archetypes and stereotypes and, you know, your kind of typical heroism in your typical victim, then...
You want to honor those and play against them and make them more complex and deliver what people are hoping for out of the cycle.
This is what I feel like we miss from the movie, is just this little part of the journey, just to get you to where you
the
need
Gorgoroth
to be.
The Gorgoroth planes here.
You know? That little extra bit of...
Heavy.
Physical,
that orc armor
physical
was heavy.
Fatigue to get you to where you need to be at the end. You know?
Like that, look there. Look at how far they must have had to go if they had to cross all that.
See, that's the
wearing
thing.
Wearing that heavy orc armor.
And you don't really get that sense.
No.
In the theatrical.
And you're going uphill, you know.
It was freezing when we did these scenes. Freezing.
Thank God he's got under that helmet. Kind of catch his breath.
Come on, Mr. Reese. It's such a weight to carry.
I believe this is also a comment on how heavy the ring is becoming. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really important moment just in the evolution of those final
hours. Yeah, it just
final
shows how
hours.
Tired we're getting.
Yeah.
My aim was so good. I was so proud of myself.
Look at you, Sean.
Yeah, get your kit off, boys.
I bet Sean was glad to get rid of that backpack. Had that on for a year and a half.
He actually gave it to Sean on his wrap, which was hilarious, because he thought he got rid of it, and Pete gave him back his backpack to carry it back to L.A. Poor guy. Poor Sean.
And that's beautiful music. Listen to that.
There's light. Beauty up there.
Oh, this is that scene.
No shadow.
Fran played this incredible violin concerto on the stage when she was directing us in this. You know what they chose to put back in there was the stuff we actually did outside, as opposed to that beautiful...
Interesting.
Scene on the stage where they added in all that poetry.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually a really interesting point. This is one of the few scenes that we reshot, and they actually went back to the original. Because we did reshoot it on a stage.
We were much physically colder that day.
With a nighttime... It was shot in the dark, as if it was night, whereas that was in the day. And it was very, very cold.
I sort of get why they chose to go back to it, because... It does sort of hit you viscerally a little bit more that we're, like, out, subject to the elements and the cold, and not
And also, your performance is a little bit more shaky and tired than being on the set.
Yeah, as opposed to...
A little bit. It felt right coming out of those scenes.
Yeah.
There's a few drops left.
I always think this when I see a film where people are gasping for water, and then they get it, and then they let some fall out. I think that's a shame, that.
Yeah, you wouldn't do that, would you? You'd save it. Water is the juice of life.
Iskaba. That's Gaelic for the water of life.
Is that right?
Yes.
Fantastic.
A lot of this was the New Zealand Army. So as you've seen there, they can do that for real.
Yeah.
I remember Carol, who was the first AD, and some of the other assistant directors said that the days with the New Zealand Army as extras were the best days ever, because they could just say, could everyone move 3 feet to the left, and they'd just go, and they'd be there.
Brilliant.
Whereas normally extras be like, what? How much?
Yeah, what time's lunch?
It's still awkward to me, the topography, the where are, you know... I think in the earlier movies, when we leave the Shire and we...
You have more of a sense of where you actually are.
Yeah, and it's hard because just the physical logistics of what piece of the volcano we were shooting on, or what piece of that barren Gorgoroth Plains kind of missile range that we were shooting on, or...
I became kind of confused as well, not to mention the fact that if we were ever on set, we were shooting against, you know, a very similar rock background every time, so you do start to lose perspective as to where you are in that journey.
Here we go. This was all done so near Ruapehu.
Yes, we were in Ruapehu. Why, I wasn't very clear, because it was very early on in the filming and I didn't know what we were doing. I didn't know whether we were doing film 2 or 3. And I didn't know quite who Gandalf the White was, but I was put through my paces. And so, rather in awe of the location.
I remember turning up to work that day, and we had a briefing by an army sergeant, and apparently we were shooting on a munitions range where they did all firing of weapons and stuff, and he picks up an array of weapons, and he picks up like a little bomb, and he says, if you see one of these, don't touch it. He picks up a fragment of some ghastly-looking weapons. If you see one of these, please call us, you know. Picks up a landmine. If you see one of these, don't come near it, you know. He was sort of shooting in the most sort of... There's all these sort of unspent, misfired sort of armaments and ordnance lying around.
So it was kind of fun. People were finding bullets and...
Orlando found a bullet.
Yeah.
He was very happy about that, wasn't he?
I picked up a shell and I polished it up and I had it on the makeup bus. I kept polishing it up and trying to get it, like, all cleaned up and stuff. Yeah, it's exact. Well, if you tell me not to do something, I'm bound to do it. That was the way. But I think I did ask. I got permission from one of the army guys.
Welcome.
This is a nice moment that I really miss from the movie, where you actually get a physical representation of the evil of Sauron. It's the Dark Lieutenant, which I absolutely loved. Just because you don't see Sauron. Sauron doesn't come out, and that was a decision that was, you know, a long time in the making as to how they were going to deal with the ultimate villain.
The eye was going to take physical form as the most beautiful being on Earth, and that was going to be played by, like, they were talking about doing Kate Winslet or Kate Blanchett, maybe, but she was obviously, she didn't quite play Galadriel, but there were some really trippy ideas tossed about.
Because the history of Sauron, which I was fascinated to learn, is that he's a Mayan spirit. He's like a fallen angel, you know, he's almost like Lucifer. I actually love that they were toying around with that briefly, that idea of bringing out this beautiful man to kind of entice Aragorn and, you know, manipulate Aragorn in Sauron's true physical form, but they ended up abandoning that, I think for obvious reasons, mainly because it's not in the book A, and not every fan or every person going to see the movie would understand it. I still love this, though.
I hate that.
Because even though you don't get Sauron, you do get a sense that there are these physical minions.
Another emissary, another... Yeah. Oh, it just makes me sick to my stomach.
Oh, it's great.
I was always a bit disappointed that Merry was behind Eomer, because he doesn't get to see that much stuff, whereas Pippin is in front of Gandalf. That always got on my nerves a little bit, but maybe it's written.
Probably got on a...
That would be Pete's main excuse when you weren't happy with something. It's written!
Elijah was just, like, so beat at this point. Man.
It was a new kind of fatigue. I've never known true fatigue until Lord of the Rings.
I think you're sort of famous now, though, for being able to sleep anywhere. Everybody likes to talk about how uncanny it is.
My secret party trick?
Yeah, you can, like, push the button and Elijah, he's out. You're like C-3PO. Just turn him off.
Because we were working straight through. Sometimes we were doing, like, 18-hour days. I remember going home and thinking, right, if I get into bed now, I'm going to get 5 hours sleep before I have to get up. As soon as I walked in the door, I was like, if I get into bed now, I'm going to get 5 hours sleep. Those were the sort of hours we were doing towards the end. It was crazy. In the last 3 weeks, it was just like constant. I don't know how Pete did it, man. I don't know how he did it.
I remember filming all this stuff where they had the army. And on the kind of group shots, they would film everyone. So like 200 people, and then they move them all along, and then film them all again.
Oh, is that what happened?
Yeah. So we could get much bigger group shots.
I see in your eyes the same fear that would take the heart of me.
I loved that speech that Ego did. I remember standing there watching him do that. Actually, all of the army I was looking around, they were all like tingling, you know. It's like one of those sort of arousing the troop speeches, and he really nailed it, I thought. It was a real education watching him do that.
But it is not this day! This day we fight!
And he was very, you know, he was very at one with that horse by the time he was doing that, so it was cool. There was one point in one take, I don't know if it's this one, where he rides, and then he stopped, and the horse did a rear. There it is, yeah, that rear. It was just so cool because it was on the, in that moment, because he'd done it so many times, and then the horse did this little rear, and it was just perfect timing. It just happened in the moment. It wasn't choreographed, and the horse wasn't trained to do it. It was just something that had occurred, and I guess it was the adrenaline of Viggo on the horse, and, you know, because horses really respond to you when you're on them, so. But it was a cool moment.
Do you remember I had two mates staying with me at the same, Paul and Martin?
Yeah.
So Martin had been there for about a week, and he kept coming to set, and you know how films are, they, especially
things like this where you've got hundreds of people. It takes a long time to set up a shot. Then you get a shot done and it might only be 15 seconds. And so he'd come to set every day and hang around for a few hours and then go back. And then Paul arrived and he was driving him up to set and he was saying, look, don't expect to see anything because, you know, I've been coming here every day and there's nothing happening. And it just happened that day. There was three units all filming different battle scenes at the same time. And Paul said, as Martin came over the ridge of this hill, he looked down and it looked like a war. There was just like 1,000 people all battling. He said, and right in the centre, there was Ian McKellen dressed in white, just taking out all these soldiers. And he's like, what? What do you mean nothing's happening?
I thought I'd die fighting side by side with an elf.
It's the ultimate reconciliation, isn't it? It isn't, I love you, get Legolas, I love you too, Gimli. It's not that, it's just, never expected to die next to one of your type. Well, how about staying next to a friend? Yeah. Well, now you put it that way, I think I could do that. Yeah.
Oh, boy. I remember this scene so well. This whole last sequence for me, and I think for you as well, Sean, was just so important. Something I both feared and look forward to at the same time. I mean, for me, that last scene where I collapse in your arms and Frodo isn't Frodo anymore, and he can't remember the Shire and, you know, all that he holds so dear, and he's essentially dying. I mean, it is the culmination of his journey. It's the ring having its full effect on him, and also your heroism, and it just had to be so right.
It's hard to know which part of my consciousness to bring to bear on talking about it in the DVD commentary, because there's so many complex...
You know, this was my audition scene, right? The scene where I'm in your arms and...
No. Oh, you've told me that.
It was very intimate. I remember shooting it. I mean, it was very... between you and me and what we were both driving ourselves to accomplish.
For me, in my life as an actor, this was the most significant dramatic work of my life. I mean, it was a sacred moment on that volcano. I remember the day so clearly, and we had invested enough time kind of enduring just the physical labor of shooting the movie that when it came to doing this, the release of it all, and just seeing the tears streaming down Peter's face when we were shooting it, was such a kind of emotional vote of confidence to even go deeper. And
what a relief, man, that night after we knew, you know, there was a sense that we'd accomplished what we set out to accomplish, what was necessary in our minds, and the relief and the elation at having done what we felt we had done was
just pumping my fist in the air down with the makeup bus, like, yes, yes. And I remember, you know, I'd been such a intense mood for so long, and people were like, wow, you're really happy. I was like, we nailed it. We just nailed this moment, you know?
Yeah. Such a sad moment, and man, you kill me every time. This kills me too. This moment where he turns around and says, for Frodo. I mean, that sense that he is now being challenged by Sauron, breaks out of it, and decides to charge the army that they have no chance against, to give Frodo that extra bit of time, is just ripe with emotion. Kills me every time.
For Frodo.
Oh, God. Vig, so beautiful.
I remember doing this. Do you remember this, though?
Yeah, this was great fun. What Pete wanted was for the hobbits to, you know, lead into battle with Aragorn and then to be taken over by the rest of the army.
We were all lined up, and it was like a running race at school. It was like, he's going to get there first, you know, let's get there. And the doubles for the hobbits, who were just running their little hearts out, and, you know, everyone was so spurred up.
Everybody on this film was just, you know, 5,000,000% committed to what we were doing.
This picture brings the best out of everybody. There aren't many circumstances in life that do that.
My first week in New Zealand was up at Ruapehu shooting this climactic sequence. Beginning of 5 years of work, and you're doing your last scene. And I remember turning up on set in my white lycra outfit with a shaved head, crawling around as Gollum, but then everybody thinking at that point, Gollum's going to be a CG character, what's this actor doing here?
We shot this fight scene so many different times.
Well, we shot it once on the actual side of the mountain, and then again on this set, and the version in the film is slightly shorter. It doesn't include the dialogue between Gollum and I, which is great, because you lose this great moment where he says,
"Speak aloud."
Oh, my God. And I remember of the day, him freaking me out. I mean, it...
Yeah, I remember.
You know, that's a real interesting thing to comment on as well, is Andy would so put himself into that character. For all intents and purposes, Gollum was on set every day.
I think in the animation, they'd have to take some of the intensity off for the actual character of Gollum.
Because it was so frightening. I was very bruised.
Yeah, when we have fight scenes, he would grab so hard, you'd have...
Even on that day, I remember putting his hands around my neck to tighten them, because I wanted to make it a little bit easier for me to be more realistic in my choking.
You see the dirt on his
and
back?
And by
right
doing
there?
That, it caused me to cut off a little bit of my breath and strain my face, which broke all the blood vessels in my face. Do you remember that?
I remember.
A lot of people ask the question, where does Frodo get his strength from?
You asked Peter that. I remember you asked Peter that.
He's nearly dead on his feet, and then suddenly he's running up the side of the mountain. I've been asked many times. The logic behind it is that the ring is being threatened once again to be taken away from Frodo. It's that fight with Gollum and that threat again to the ring that gives him that added bit of strength.
That battle sequence was done on our knees in principal photography.
Yeah.
The on knees thing started off as something that we could do. We could just do little pickups of, you know, a head turn or just tiny little things, and Pete started saying, just on your knees and we can do this. And then it kind of escalated to, do you think you could walk a couple of steps on your knees? And to the point that we did things like that battle scene all on our knees. It's hard enough just kind of try to be on your knees, you know, it's pretty painful. But when you're walking around doing battle scenes and trying to remember all your moves. Yeah, and it became a way of doing these things that, you know, it was simple and it was really effective.
I remember when I saw how Andrew Lesney was lighting these and we put the dirt on, and I remember seeing your close-up and just thinking how extraordinary. Like, I didn't get it. I didn't get it when I read the script. I didn't get how this moment was going to be. And then when I saw what was with the wind and the smoke and the redness of the lava, and it just remember on the day, just like that moment of realization, how powerful it is.
Mm.
Just try it.
I can't.
Do it.
I can't.
Why can't you just let it go?
Well, it's taking over him.
Do it.
I can't.
Throw it in.
I can't.
Why?
Because it's taking him over.
If that was me, I'd be terrified that I'd fall in, wouldn't you? I'd stand back.
Yeah, I would lie down.
Yeah.
And I remember there were so many different ways that we worked on that particular moment of that decision, you know, that line, the ring is mine, and the different deliveries and the different takes on that. I think I'm ultimately happy with the one that they chose. There are so many different ones that I... different levels in intensity and...
Yeah. And I love that kind of lightning effect on the...
Yeah, it's wild. I don't quite know where that's coming from. Maybe the same place the music is.
Yeah, exactly.
But I love it. It's great.
This shot
just makes the atmosphere in there so intense. That's the other thing, you know, about certain moments like that are so specific, is that you run through, you know, in your mind, the ultimate palette. You know, you try it every possible way, and ultimately what they choose may not necessarily be the one that you...
It's not just the takes that are chosen. It's how much... pacing is on the head of it or on,
right,
the back of it, and then
right,
how it plays, how the music
against,
and the intercutting of other things. It's I like that with time my ideas of other things sort of fade, my recollections of the other options fades, and I'm allowed to finally, with increasing intensity over time, experience it the way audiences experience it, because I know how powerful and moving it is for audiences, and I want to have that in common with them.
Yeah.
So the final moments, Gollum on this Middle Earth, was actually technically one of the most challenging parts of it. We had a very large stuntman. I was in my motion capture suit. I galloped on the ground and then leapt up top of this stuntman's back, and he's literally throwing me around. And the biting off of Frodo's finger, Elijah's shot had already been taken, and then we had to match to that, but I was actually... it had a carrot placed in between the stuntman's fingers. So when I actually bent down, and now I'm grabbing hold of that stuntman's wrist, pulling it off, I'm biting a carrot there, pulling it off, and then I tumble off, and I do, in fact, get to have that moment in the book, which is the dance of ecstasy, where he's jumping up and down, screaming, "The precious, the precious." This is one of my favourite shots of Gollum in the film.
Yes. Yes, that's rare. I finally got to stand up after Peter had made me crawl around for 4 years. And there we have it. Yes.
We kind of initially played it. We were trying to be ambiguous with it, but I think the way that it was originally shot, it kind of felt too much like Frodo had actually made that decision to push him off. Or that it was too accidental. Like, I think there was also a version where Gollum actually just sort of tripped and fell, which is too anticlimactic. So we shot it again, and I had made a choice, regardless of whether that was apparent on screen or not, I had made a choice that Frodo's reason for stalking Gollum at the edge of the precipice and essentially grabbing for the ring wasn't to get the ring away from Gollum and destroy it, or to kill Gollum necessarily, but to get the ring back. Because he had made that decision to keep the ring, so...
But I think it's clear in the movie, when you see it, what you're saying, it's that idea that the ring is destroying itself, like you guys both going for the ring to keep it for yourselves because
yes,
you want it.
And accidentally the ring falls in with Gollum.
Yeah, it consumes itself.
But falling, we tried it, I did it again on the motion capture stage, built on a rig so I could fall backwards, and we shot it about 20, 25 times. It was very, very hard to encapsulate what is going on in Gollum's mind at those final moments. And what it, I think, is about is almost a moment of relief. It's a moment of... The pain's almost gone. Where does he go from there? Where does the character go from there on in? He's got the object that's been driving him. And in a sense, it's a moment of relief before the agony. He doesn't even really sense the agony of being burnt to a cinder, which again gives a power back to the ring.
I think Frodo at this very moment, I think Frodo wants to let go. There is a moment that I believe,
yeah,
that Frodo is ready to let go.
I love LOVE in capital letters, the fact that the ring sits on the top of the molten lava for a while.
Still like, trying to save itself.
Yeah, the ring itself has its own power and doesn't want to be destroyed.
This battle with the cave troll of sorts, it wasn't a troll at all, but it was actually Sauron. So all this battle sequence was with some human in Sauron battle gear, and then it was covered over by this cave troll.
That shot, I think I did in pickups as well, reacting. That was the last shot. When you knew the tower was going down, we all knew what that meant, you know. And it was, but it was supposed to range from shock or to joy, happiness.
And all those shots, I think, certainly mine was filmed in pickup shots on a green screen, and we just tried to think of where we would be at the end of this battle, and then we'd have one shot of being excited that we understand that the ring's been destroyed, and then do another shot of also knowing that Frodo and Sam have died. And here's another story that never makes it in because, you know, we're not warriors, and
right,
people don't want to know us being, like, brave.
I hear you.
Because we're hobbits. But one day I had toothache on set, and I thought, well, I'm going to have to go to the dentist. I was dying. And they said, okay, we'll take you at lunchtime. So we went up, was dressed as a hobbit, so I was all covered up because I was still trying to keep it secret what hobbits look like. Went to the dentist, and they said, well, you're going to need a filling. And they said, actually, you'll need two. And I said, well, I've got to do some dialogue this afternoon, so can we do it without any anaesthetic? And they said, yeah, but it's going to hurt. I said, well, let's start it, and then we'll see how it goes. And they drilled this filling, and the pain was unbelievable. So much so that I sweated so much that my hobbit feet fell off in the dentist chair. I swear to you. It was hilarious.
That's pain, man.
So, when I got back to the set, they had to reapply my hobbit feet. So I could have saved time just by getting the anaesthetic and, you know, keeping my hobbit feet on.
You're a hero.
I was a hero that day. And when I got back in the afternoon, they changed the schedule and I didn't have any dialogue.
There you have your old pyroclastic lava flow. Not a good thing to be in. Added to which, there may be a little bit of sulfur there and not too much oxygen.
It's done.
There was a sense that that wasn't necessarily a heroic act. You know, the idea that the ring doesn't necessarily... isn't destroyed because of Frodo's will. That he doesn't actually carry out or finish his task. And I don't see it that way at all. I mean, I think ultimately the reality of the situation is that Frodo is still the hero, but it's his humanity for keeping Gollum alive and keeping him on the journey and not killing Gollum earlier when he had ample, you know, opportunity that has made it so that Gollum continues to play his role, to be there for that moment, to take the ring away from him again, to ultimately accidentally lead him to his death. So it is Frodo's humanity in keeping Gollum alive to make sure that he's there for that moment, to allow that to happen.
Light. The party tree.
This is a beautiful moment of finally being free of that burden and being able to remember everything again and have a sense of self again, but also a beautiful moment for you as you kind of...
We've done our job and now there's nothing left. There's nothing to be done. So Sam can be selfish.
Yeah.
We can both be selfish and together and...
Because Sam is actually finally allowed, you know, to emotionally let go, you know.
And you've resumed your position as the sort of protector of Sam.
Yeah.
The leader of Sam, you know.
Glad to be with you, Sam, my Scamtree.
I also just love that. It's back to the friendship, you know. I'm so glad to be with you, Samwise Gamgee, here at the end of all things. That has been one of my favorite lines in the entire trilogy.
That's such a tender, honest...
But also because it rings so true for you and I, you know, and our experience as friends and as brothers making this film and going through that journey and knowing what it took for us to go through, what we went through making these films, you know. I mean, there's so much wrapped up into that moment.
So... it fades out. So in a sense, the movie could almost end right there. We could have died there. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And then everything that happens after this, from the fade in, beyond, is gravy.
The dream sequence? This is like a David Lynch movie.
Mm-hmm.
None of this is real.
I really didn't know. In the books, this really bothered me. It's like, if Gandalf could just get on the damn bird and go get him, why didn't he do it, like, you know, 2 hours ago or 10 chapters ago?
I hear that a lot about the Army of the Dead, too. Well, the Army of the Dead could just sweep through Minas Tirith.
But this is the genius of Peter Jackson, because what he's allowing, he and Howard Shore, and Tolkien, I mean, they allow you, just cinematically, it's such a beautiful thing that says... this isn't about the logic of the story. This is about the emotionality of that sense of completion and the sense of loss or the sense of rebirth or the sense of death or whatever, all of those things commingling into this incredible kind of orchestral release, you know?
This was very peaceful.
This was a sequence that we always had worries about. Once the jeopardy is gone, and now Frodo has to, you know, see everyone again, how we make this work and it not be kind of cheesy goosebumps.
It's a bit of a Wizard of Oz scene.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the old...
there's so much Wizard of Oz in this movie, I can't even believe it. I watched
the old
Wizard of Oz.
And you were there, and you were there, and, you know...
But there's,
which I was so worried, and I voiced it on the day. I said, Pete, it's a little bit... Dorothy waking up after being in Oz and sort of seeing everybody again. And he's like, no, trust me, it'll play. And it does, it really does play.
And I thought this was so funny.
Oh, Frodo!
You know, where they all... because look at that, they were so, like, gleeful, excited, you know, it was perfect.
I wonder if you can catch any of the things that we were talking about. I remember we were talking about Treebeard in here and all the kind of things that we'd done. That Frodo wouldn't know about.
That's right, yeah. Hobbits are such fans of telling stories, they immediately just jump into what they've been doing.
Yeah.
This is also the laughter scene.
I know, you guys actually...
everyone just pissing themselves with laughter. It is really nice. It is such a release. I think that's ultimately what it is. It is such a release after that intense amount
it's
of
angelic.
Darkness.
It's beautiful. I mean, it really is beautiful.
It is.
That glowing, that sort of...
It's regal, it's beautiful.
Ah, where's Boromir?
No, he's dead.
Yeah, that's a shame, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm digitally composited into that moment there.
Hey, up!
I don't know what that was that I did there, but Pete obviously liked it. I was reenacting getting punched in the face by an Uruk-hai.
That's really sweet. That the two have this understanding between
every,
them.
Every one of these scenes, these endings that we filmed, it you never knew, like, which one he was going to use, or is he going to use all of them? And so, like, how do you...
He used all of them.
7 out of 12 ain't bad.
I think it's completely necessary. I've actually spoken with people who have issue with, why are there so many endings?
There's kind of a running joke now with people talking about how many kind of endings there are to the movie, but I don't really feel that too much. And also, there's a lot of main characters that you have to wrap up the story with, you know, so I think all these supposed endings are all really valid.
I love Minas Tirith.
How many times?
What?
Broken record.
Sorry.
That's all right. Not many people, not many men, can pull off a crown. But Viggo can pull off a crown. Thus.
Now come the days of the king.
I always thought that Viggo was cleanly shaven for this, but did they film it once when he was cleanly shaven?
Don't think so.
You sure?
No.
I remember one day in at the trailers, and he was all cleanly shaven. We said, what are you filming? And he said, the coronation. Remember?
No.
Remember?
No.
Remember?
I like the messy Aragorn myself. The grubby Aragorn, the one who doesn't wash.
Shay does not belong to one man.
Given the time in world history when the movies were released, there was real war going on, and so to have him sort of both politically and then in this poetic, artistic way to basically say that fighting's not really where it's at is, I just think, what allows the movie to be received by people as an important artistic offering. It's what makes it worthy of its Oscar nominations and the money that it's made and everything else, because ultimately all of it is in service of that point. It's the return of the king.
What's he singing about here?
This was his Christmas number one when he was 19. It's a slowed down version of Dirty by Christina Aguilera.
That's true.
Done in old language speech.
The coronation's another really beautiful frock that I just wore for a couple of minutes. That was such a lovely dress, that dress. I would have loved to have kept that.
Here comes beautiful.
What is he wearing on his head?
Thranduil was the king of Mirkwood, the king of the Mirkwood elves. Thranduil is my father, and so I wear a crown in this last sequence because I'm a prince.
The crown works on Viggo. I don't think we've ever seen Orlando look more girly.
He looks great.
Yeah, Orlando can pull anything off.
I always felt so strange doing stuff with all the other elves. Because as Legolas, you know, he's sort of... Especially at this point, I used to look around and think, God, so the elves are such a mad race. Legolas sort of becomes this kind of... He becomes so much a part of the fellowship that he sort of loses some of that. Some of what you're seeing there is a company of elf. He sort of becomes this kind of warrior elf that has a different presence to him, I think. And so when I was together with all the elves, which, you know, a whole bunch of day players, really, it was just mad being around them. And I remember Liv saying, God, we're such a peculiar race. You know, when you look around at us, we're all so tall and slender and long and lean and kind of otherworldly.
Oh, all the girls were crying when they shot that scene.
I had actually just gotten married, so I kind of tried to just think about and remember what that moment for me was like. Quite personal, but we spent a whole day shooting that scene, and we really focused on it, and everybody felt really good about it. And then, like, a day or two later, they realized that we'd forgotten about Elrond completely, and somehow he wasn't in the scene. So we had to reshoot that again with Elrond. And that was actually my last day of shooting ever. That little pickup was the very last moment that we shot. It was very emotional.
The coronation was all shot separately too, everybody. I mean, David and I were there at the same time, but I don't think Carl was there when I was shooting. And Viggo wasn't there, and Ian wasn't there. Liv wasn't there, Hugo wasn't there. I think everybody came in and did their little bit separately, and the hobbits certainly weren't there.
Where were we doing this, Tom?
We're in a studio in Wellington, and we're actually looking at nothing, aren't we? There's no one there.
Just us. And Pete. And this was the last shot the four hobbits ever did together.
Not true.
Principal photography.
Principal photography, yeah.
And once we got it, they brought in a bottle of champagne each.
Yeah.
And we fired off the corks. I got a Polaroid of that, and that's on my refrigerator door this day. And some days I look at it, Dom, and I think, there's three of my good friends, and I weep a little tear. And then I just open the door and I make myself some cheese and toast. I love Minas Tirith.
Shut it. And the parchment maps, man. As long as he kept cutting to those in the movie, to me, it makes the movie. Look at how he photographs it with this sweeping shot, this kind of crane shot over the maps. Because when I got the books, I would open them up and I would study those maps, but it actually feels like you're flying through. It echoes all those helicopter shots, and it gives it that mythic historical reality.
There's the Shire, Bywater, Hobbiton.
What if they include that great shot on the hilltop? No, they don't. There was a great shot of the hobbits that we did in a pickup, actually, and interesting for all you to know that when they would pull out of the map, they would go to a shot that we did in the pickups of the four hobbits riding up on top of a hill that overlooked the Shire. And I really love that because they had the full perspective of their homeland stretching out before them. And it was then that they finally said, you know, without saying it, we're home.
This was the last shot ever that the four hobbits did together.
I think Pete really liked the idea that, you know, we went out and done all this incredible stuff that we've done, but to the old people in the Shire, they just think, oh, what are young people wearing these days? But we don't even need to say anything to each other. We just know.
This is one of my favorite scenes as well. The soldiers return from battle in a land that knows not what they've been through, and they can't. Only they know what they've been through, and they can't really relate to the world around them in the same way anymore. Forever changed. I mean, it's that classic kind of Vietnam vet or World War II vet coming home.
There's so many great bookends in this movie. If you look at the first film and then you look at the end of this last film, the echoes and the answers thematically, visually.
No, it is wonderful.
I love this shot, actually. And there was a lot of talk of doing different things in this shot. I remember for about a week before it, Pete kept coming up and he said, what do you think the idea that one of you bring out an orc helmet and no one really cares? Or, you know, lots of different ideas. And then he settled on this very simple idea, which I think works perfectly.
Yeah, we understand each other.
Yeah, we know what he's up to. That's him off. Who knows what's going to happen here? But, yes, we do.
And you got to kiss her.
I was so glad they put that in there. I watched it with my wife at the premiere, and it was one of the only times where I had a kissing scene in a movie where she wasn't upset by it. It just felt so...
It was pure and beautiful.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Except for when Billy and Viggo were off camera kissing each other as a motivation for us to look at.
Because we heard they were filming this, and we said, let's go and be the crowd and help them out. So we ran into the set, and then when they turned around, it was me and Viggo applauding them, and yay, yay. And then Viggo grabbed me and kissed me hard, open-mouthed, on the lips.
I also like this thing that they added. We added this in ADR, this voiceover about how do you rebuild your life after having gone through what you've gone through, and that there are these wounds, both physical and wounds that kind of stretch to your soul that may never heal. And
this
I love
scene
that.
Here, not the what you were just talking about, but this next one coming up, Pete was going to cut. And I remember being out in the trailer, and I was told that, oh, they're going to cut that scene. I was stunned, and I raced into the stage and said, Peter, I don't understand. How can you cut this? This is the... And like, we're here. Like, let's at least shoot it. You don't have to put it in the movie, but we're here at the stage. And I remember thinking, like, wait a minute. Is he testing me? Like, is he testing me to see if there's anything that I'll fight for or something? Or by begging him to shoot it, and then we shot it. And then I always got the sense afterwards, like, he would have shot it anyway, but he just wanted me to have that feeling.
This is kind of interesting. There's a close-up that we added in the pickups just here. This is the last shot that I filmed for The Lord of the Rings. And it was so emotionally intense because what Frodo is saying, I mean, it's essentially saying in the subtext that he's not going to come back, that he knows he's leaving, and that there's room for a little more in this book, and he knows why. He's leaving it for Sam, and he knows he's going to leave. And, God, it completely echoed the exact position that I was in, having spent 4 years of my life in New Zealand with that crew, with this group of actors, with that director as that character, and suddenly it all come to that moment, which was so... It was almost too perfect, you know?
I loved reading the voiceover of There and Back Again, A Hobbit's Tale, and The Lord of the Rings by Frodo Baggins, you know, by Bilbo Baggins, and The Lord of the Rings by Frodo Baggins, because it felt like getting to read it, I felt like that I got to be the narrator for a second.
Yeah.
And it just to sort of capture the mood of the totality of the story just in a moment for the audience. I really liked doing
that. It's a great moment.
The elves have accorded you a special honor. Place on the last ship to leave Middle-earth.
I remember being in awe of this scene, just thinking how...
I'm in awe of Ian Holm.
It's great to do any scene with Ian Holm. I always thought Elijah must have had such a great time being able to do some scenes just with Ian Holm, because he's a master.
What little I had an opportunity to work with him was always so special.
I'm afraid I lost it.
I also love that idea that, you know, Bilbo... After all that time away from the ring, asks to see it one last time, and Frodo has to say that he lost it. So sweet.
See, that's a lie. He didn't lose it.
Well...
He's lying to an old man.
You should never do that.
If they ask, you know, is this the number 72 bus going to the supermarket, you should say yes. If it is.
If it is.
Oh, how much did you all want to kill me when we did this one?
This sequence was shot twice. The reason being, Sean Astin was unfortunately not dressed in the right clothes the first time that we shot it.
It was amazing because Dom and Bill and Sean put so much into the emotional release of that scene. And it was a long day and it was an intense place for all of us to go.
So we had to cry our eyes out and then come back the next day and do it all again.
Because after lunch, he forgot to put his waistcoat on. Or vest, as you call it, some places in the world.
The Yankee Doodles call it.
The Greyhaven set was I think it was a fairly low ceiling, but just a very, very, like a big box, huge warehouse. Then there was this wharf set. The set itself, down one end, if you're looking one end, there was sort of a little path and coming down to where the hobbits said goodbye to each other. And then they meant to walk out to the boat, which was... probably a platform or something, but it was all blue screen. Everything was blue, so we had to completely imagine this world, this water. It was a comical exercise because I don't think Cate Blanchett was there, even though she was meant to be. So someone else was playing her.
We did film about that. Gandalf says goodbye to Pippin, and I was kind of sad that that wasn't in it.
What does he say?
I say, "Do you have to go, Gandalf?" And he says, "My time here is over," sort of idea. And he says goodbye. And I was kind of sad at that, because they've got a kind of relationship after the third one, you know. And also, because they've cut that out, it almost looks like he says goodbye to the other hobbits and not me.
Maybe he's in a mood.
And I know that Ian wanted that in as well.
I was always a little bit disappointed with the fact that when I cry, my face does weird things. I'm not able to do that kind of sexy crying. Of your face stays the same, but you have tears rolling down your face. I have to gurn, and my chin has to wobble, and snot has to come out of my nose for me to cry.
Yeah, I was doing a bit of that.
Yeah, so I get quite a bit of hassle on the streets by people saying, "Hey, you went for that, didn't you?" No half measures.
Oh man, that,
are you immortal? Are you
look,
reborn?
Those looks on your faces as you suddenly realize what's about to happen is
that look you give is great, because it's just an anticipation of it, like the audience. If the audience is really into what's going on, you like right there, what?
Oh. The really significant thing for me that makes me cry so much is that Frodo's leaving, which is sad, but, you know, hopefully the audience know and we know that he's leaving forever. We're never, ever going to see him again because he's going to the Grey Havens. It's not like he's, you know, he's going to go to Utah.
I think, is this not the Grey Havens we're in?
All right, well, he's on his way to,
Is it the Undying Lands?
Yeah. He's on his way to Valinor.
The Undying Lands.
You can't come back from Valinor.
Well, there's no return ticket.
No. It's like Alcatraz.
I'm coming back from Alcatraz.
Nope.
Once again, they cut a couple of little lines out of here when we shot the first time. I give him a hug, and then when he moves away, I say, "You still owe me 30 quid.
Which, you know, I'm not sure if it works.
Do you have a line?
Yeah.
What did you say?
One of your hairs are in my mouth. Just when I cuddled them. Does this mean I can have your bike? Who's moving into Bag End? You've still not paid the phone bill.
None of these lines will work.
But the lines nonetheless.
It was hard to... I mean, it still is hard to watch this scene because it's like watching myself say goodbye to my friends. There is so much reality at play in this scene. You know, and the idea of having to say goodbye to you forever or Billy forever or Dom forever is a very difficult thing to get my head around. So it's difficult to watch.
I love that the movie is almost a... It's a treatise on, like, how to let go, you know?
Oh, particularly this one. And Unafraid. It's the wonderful thing about hobbits. There is something so pure about them, you know? They wear everything on their sleeve. They wear their complete and utter joy on their sleeve as well as their complete sadness, you know?
I remember that moment in the beginning of the first one when we see the elves and I say, they're sailing across the sea. I don't know why. It makes me sad. And now here you are, getting ready to... You're going to sail across the sea.
Look at my face. I can't... I can't do it without looking like some invisible hands are squishing my face. Everything moves towards my nose. But I'm in the moment, that's what matters.
Mate, that's... You're right. Too many actors worry about what they look like and not about, you know, playing the moment. And you're playing the moment. That makes you a fine actor. Look...
For me, it was really about getting back to where Frodo was before all this had happened to him and really showing the complete evolution of that character, the complete release, the burden of that ring to purity and innocence once again, and to try and convey that in a look and in a smile.
Look at that smile. And that's how we will always remember him.
So you seem to be saying with a look, you know...
It's going
to
be okay.
I'm going to be okay. You're going to be okay, and I'm going to be okay, whether it's death or life.
It's funny, because someone did ask me during one of those Q&As, you know, what were you thinking and what was behind that look, and there seems to be a certain nod, and what are you saying with that nod? And when I was asked, I couldn't come up with it, and finally it occurred to me, it is that. It's saying, I'm going to be okay, and so are you, and you need to go on.
Mm-hmm.
And everything's, you know, everything's okay.
Right, we should probably go because we're not in it anymore.
Well, let's mention something. Come on.
Really? I've got an appointment. We should. All right. Well, we'll stay then.
Right. Let's see. Where is this?
Now, this is beautiful. Look.
This is in Hamilton, and the little beautiful girl running out here now is Sean Astin's daughter, Ally. Oh.
Look at her. 2.5, right? Or 3?
She was just 3 there. My little Ally, Alexandra Louise. This has to be my single favorite thing about the entire experience, was being able to...
Oh, God, man.
...capture that moment in time.
Absolutely.
With her, with my real daughter.
Who's now 7.
Who's now 7. She did well, and she gave Peter what he wanted.
That was beautiful.
He didn't ask too much, you know?
Yeah.
He said, would you do this, Ally? And she did it.
The baby here that Sarah is holding is her baby. So there's a lot of families.
So for 10 points, what's Sam's daughter called?
Sam's daughter is called Goldilocks.
Nice work. And Pippin, if you read the end of the story, gets married to Diamond of Longcleeve, and they have a son who they call Faramir. And Faramir and Goldilocks get married.
And that's the great victory for the normal. That after earth-shattering events, in the end, decency, society, the bond of the family, babies, these are the proper destiny of men.
Oh. Thanks, Pete. Thanks for putting some of the scenes back in.
So that's it, guys. That is the end of the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
That's the end there. This is it. This is it now. This is the end of the commentary of the end of the movie, which is the end of the trilogy, which is the end of The Lord of the Rings.
Which is the end of your life as you know it.
Please don't say that.
It's true.
Take it back.
Right, I didn't mean that, sorry.
Take it back.
I take it back.
Is that you taking it back?
Yeah, I've taken it back.
You're forgiven.
Thanks.
These sketches, it's just such a stunning tribute.
And what a wonderful bookend to the film as well, to end with the conceptual art. It historically links you to what Tolkien was trying to create, and that's always what I've thought of Alan Lee's work as being able to give you some sense of
a bridge artistically to that world. How do you get there? And Pete has said time and again, you know, what they did to gain inspiration was go to these drawings. So
it's great. It just brings it back to the book.
It does. It puts us into the context of the tradition of Lord of the Rings.
I think the world's got me to thank for the credits at the end of the third film. I said to Peter, can't you revive that tradition of seeing the actors' faces next to their names, particularly with such a long cast list as this? If you're not quite certain who is who, and the credits tend to go past rather fast, it would be such a help, you know, just to have the face by the name. I was always making good suggestions, not just to Peter, to the world in general, and nobody pays any regard to what I say. Except on this case, it happened, and no one could have been more thrilled than I when I suddenly thought, oh my goodness me, he did think it was a good idea. And then to commission Alan Lee to complete his journey on the film, the man who illustrated the books, and set for Mid John Howe for us what we expected Middle-earth to look like. Don't underestimate their contribution. And there we all are. So, yes, with our drawings. And, yep, I suggested that. Maybe other people did too.
I'd love mine. I'd love to have a copy of it. Hint, hint. In fact, I'd like them all. It'd be great to have a whole collection, wouldn't it, in a book. Put it together in a book.
It's a fantastic drawing. I would love a copy. That's all I can say. It's beautiful.
By this point, I was thinking, oh, it'll be great because there'll be a lovely sketch of Gollum. And I had no idea that I'd be up there as well.
Yes, Precious, of course you're going to be up there because we love you, really.
Well, thank you very much.
No, no, we do. We do. You, we couldn't have done it without
you. Oh, shut up.
I feel privileged when they read Tolkien. And there will be people as they get older who, at the moment, are too young to do this, who will read the books, because they certainly will have seen the films. They will see me as Saruman. They will see Elijah as Frodo. They will see everybody as they are on the screen, because Tolkien doesn't describe precisely how everybody looks. He doesn't describe what Frodo looks like, or Sam. He doesn't describe exactly what Aragorn looks like. I don't think he facially, physically describes any of his characters. Inevitably, people are going to say, well, Gimli, that's John Rhys-Davies.
The film never ceases to take my breath away when I see it. And all made in Wellington. Wellington, New Zealand. Who the heck would have thought that you could make a picture like this anywhere outside the great film capitals of the world? Well, I guess Wellington, New Zealand is one of the great film capitals of the world. Glad I was part of it.
Possibly one of the most interesting things was that we became a fellowship of men and women from all over the world who gathered in this corner of New Zealand, or like the United Nations. We proved that it could be done. And it was done easily. It was so easy to be open to each other. So we see each other now. We'll be friends for life, there's no question about that. Because we went through the tough times and the happy times. And I guess it has changed my life, the privilege of being involved in it in the first place.
I was blessed to have found myself in New Zealand amongst a creative team under the direction and guidance of a genius like Peter Jackson, and in the company of some of the most beautiful human beings that I think I'll ever meet, and working on material like J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, which was adapted for the screen. I'm not sure when I'm ever going to really believe I did it. I'm almost like, I don't know when it's ever going to really feel real to me. It was a magical time. It's made me a different person, certainly a different actor than I would have been otherwise. But everything after that, having worked on that, I thought, that's the bar, and I've got to keep the work up there. This is an experience of a lifetime, and I just want everything to be as good, and I've got to do everything in my power to try and create something that can have the same, you know, everything else has got to try and live up to that.
Great, I've enjoyed this, Tom.
Shouldn't we ever do DVD commentary again?
Yeah, maybe for something, but certainly not for Lord of the Rings. But one thing I'm glad of is that we didn't have to be naked this time.
Yeah. I didn't understand the footnotes last time about being naked. They said that that clothes can affect the microphones and stuff, but we're wearing clothes now, it doesn't feel any different.
But I don't see why we have to be dressed as farmers' wives.
You said that the farmers' wives thing comes in because it allows the volume of your vocal cords to be at its highest hilt.
What, because the petticoat seems to be quite tight around...
Yeah, it's like wearing a corset.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it feels good, don't get me wrong.
Can I put these potatoes down now?
Yeah, they must be heavy.
You should put down those carrots.
Yeah, and I'll just take off this hat.
Well, that's it. Don't rent it next time, buy it. Go back and buy the other ones as well. You know you should. They'll look good in your collection.
Be good to each other!
Yeah, be nice. Spread good feelings.
Hold someone.
It's over, you gotta stop speaking now.
I can't stop speaking.
It's done.
I feel as though I've rallied the troops.
If there are people still listening at this point, it means that we have failed.
Right.
They should have gone.
Where are they gonna go?
They'll go and have a cup of tea or coffee now.
Is there a bathroom around here? I think that's what everybody says at the end of the film. Where's the toilet?
Thank you for listening to our rambling.
Yeah.
Or, well, it's been, I mean, not to get emotional on you or to reflect, but it has been the single greatest experience of my life, and I think I speak for everyone when I say that.
I concur.
And that all of you have been with us every step of the way, sharing in our experiences and sharing in what it took to bring this to your home is pretty special, and I've certainly never felt that intensely about what a movie has become after it's been released, and how it's been something that, you know, a whole world has been able to share with us, and I think that's really special.
I'm going now, because I'm going to get all emotional. Bye-bye, everybody.
I wanted to say something like, thank you
all right, calm down. Just, can someone get me a tissue?
Right, that's it, I'm off.